The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is from Oprah's Insider section. The title is Oprah Shares a Recent Experience That Left a Heartprint. Hi, Insiders. Greetings from my backyard in South Africa. On the way here, I spent a beautiful 2 days in Marrakesh. That wasn't a lot of time, of course, to experience so much magnificent culture, especially in heat that felt at times unbearable. But we did get in an exploratory visit to the souk market filled with people, spices, aromas, jewelry, rugs, juice, fresh baked bread, and every Moroccan trinket you could imagine. I bought some scarves for head wraps and handcrafted wooden boxes to hold treasured photos and notes when I get back home. And my stay there at the Amanjena was exquisite. I've got to tell you, it is a lovely hotel that was enhanced by the services of a private butler named Mehdi. Ah, Mehdi, and it's spelled M-E-H-D-I. My eyes water when I think of him. Of course he was skilled to offer impeccable service. But, oh my goodness, this young man's heart! You could feel that it was as big as the Atlas Mountains surrounding Marrakesh. So I wanted to tell you all this. On our last night there, my daughter, girl, Liliana, and I had a traditional, superbly delicious Moroccan meal served in a tent with me dancing with the musicians. When we came back to our 2-bedroom glorious suite and entered the front door, there was a surprise for me that was organized by Mehdi. Candles and flowers that read, "We love you, Oprah." Mehdi was there, and he said to me, "It's a small thing we do, but I wanted you to know how I and the staff feel about you being here." "It's a small thing, ma'am, but we hope you can feel it." And boy, did I feel it. Not only did I hear his words, I felt his heart. I received it so fully, it expanded my own heart. It was such a gratifying, humbling moment for me that there on the other side of the world, in a world so different from my own, this young man, who's 28, would go out of his way to do something so kind, so generous. A small thing, he said, that left a big impression, a forever heartprint on me. It got me thinking, how do I do that for somebody else? How do I leave someone with a heartprint, not just an act of kindness? And I want you to think about that, too. How do you leave a heartprint? I know this community is so thoughtful, so let me know if you've ever had a Mehdi moment, and what in your wildest imagination would you do to offer a Mehdi moment to someone else? Go well, and have a great week. Moving on, this is another article from Oprah's Insider. Oprah on what you learn when under pressure. Hi, Insiders. Happy Sunday to you. I hope you're staying cool in this glorious summer. We've been reading The Covenant of Water for Oprah's book club since May. An extraordinary novel, one of the best reading journeys I've ever experienced. Trust me, even though it's a lot of pages, it is so worth your time, and those of us who finished have found out that this novel offers a couple of lifetimes worth of instructions on faith, on family, on redemption. I could go on and on. There's one lesson in particular that struck me. I haven't been able to get it out of my head. It came up in a conversation when an audience member asked Abraham Verghese, the author, about his writing process. And he said his characters are not determined by the descriptions or the roles they might play, but by the decisions they make under pressure. He says he puts every character under pressure to see if they can stand up for the whole book. And this was an aha moment for me, and I think for a lot of people. Because that's not just true in writing novels, right? It's actually true in life. Our character is determined by the decisions we make under pressure. Say your marriage falls apart, or you lose your job and suddenly you've got to decide what comes next. Those are the make-or-break moments that can define who we really are. Now, we've all heard people say things like, "Oh, I know, I just wasn't myself. I was so stressed. I was overwhelmed. I was angry." When they are under pressure and do things that are not necessarily wise. But in many ways, those are the times when you're most yourself and when your true colors show. Those colors can be so magnificent. I know in my own life, I've seen someone's best self show up when they are under intense pressure, when the walls are closing in and there's nowhere to grow but upwards. So this Sunday, I want you to reflect on a moment in time when you had to make a decision under pressure. How did it show or change your character when your character was put under pressure? I hope you take a moment, reflect on this, and then watch my entire conversation with Abraham Verghese by following the link below. I look forward to hearing what you all think about character under pressure, and have a beautiful week, everybody. Keep enjoying this summer. It's going to be over soon. Can you believe it? We're mid-July already. Go well. We're in wellness now. This article is How to Hold On to Your Marbles. A leading expert on female brain health sets the record straight on staying sharp and healthy. Number one, regular but maybe not typical health screenings. For women in general, there are two tests I encourage beyond mammograms, pap smears, and colonoscopies once you're over 50. Blood work and cognitive testing. In terms of blood work, we look at lipids and metabolic markers. The basic lipid panel would be cholesterol, and you want to look at your total cholesterol, your LDL, low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, and your HDL, high-density cholesterol, because those markers tell somewhat different stories and are the ratios that are quite important for prevention of cardiovascular disease and stroke. Triglycerides are also important. You don't want to have too much fat in your body because it can create inflammation and lead to obesity and metabolic dysregulation. It's good to have a good baseline and make sure that your lipids are within normal limits. And then, if you can optimize, why not? And metabolic markers are very important. Glucose is obviously important. Your glycemia is an important factor for metabolic health, but also for brain health. Insulin and hemoglobin, A1C, are other important markers to have. Because a lot of people in this country are pre-diabetics or insulin resistant and don't realize it, that is really a problem for your heart, for your entire body, and for your brain as well. And it's something that can be really addressed, mitigated, and even reversed by undergoing or by undertaking lifestyle adjustments and modifications. And thorough cognitive testing gives you, if nothing else, a very strong baseline. Every doctor's dream, I think, is to be able to compare you to when you had no problems. So I think you're doing a favor to your doctor as well to have a solid baseline when you're feeling fine, or when you're just starting to have some changes. Number two, good brain food. Once you cut out processed food, trans, saturated fat, fast food, packaged foods, anything that is processed that doesn't come directly from nature, and focus on whole foods, your diet is already in a very good place. Processed foods come with an arsenal of chemicals and fillers and emulsifiers, and all these substances that are potentially harmful to your metabolic, cardiovascular, and brain health. We know from many studies that individuals who consume processed and fast food quite regularly have double the odds of developing dementia in late life as compared to individuals who focus more on whole food and a healthier, fresher, and less processed diet. I understand that there's a concern about access that is very real and very important, and that not everybody can afford to eat fresh, local, organic whole foods. I think it's very important to clarify that we're not talking absolutes here. So you do the best that you can. Fast food I would avoid if you can. But even if you do choose processed foods, there are different levels of processed foods. There are ultra-processed food that really, honestly should be avoided. And then there's minimally processed food or moderately processed foods that one can consume maybe in moderation or with more attention. But the healthiest diets really focus on plants. We say that food is medicine, but to be honest, and to be fair, plants are medicine because all the good nutrition that are important for health are found predominantly in plant-based foods. All the vitamins, all the minerals, all the phytonutrients come from plants. They're really crucial to support the immune system, to support the heart, to support the brain, to support your liver. Every part of your body benefits when your diet is rich in super nutrients. So you want foods that are very dense with nutrients that are supportive for health. Some people say superfoods. The technical word is nutrient-dense foods. In this regard, the Mediterranean diet is one of the most researched diets so far, and it's been labeled many times as one of the healthiest dietary patterns in the world. And now there's a greener version of the Mediterranean diet that I think really deserves attention, that focuses even more on plant-based foods. I'm not suggesting that everybody gets vegan or vegetarian. I'm just saying you really want to make sure that you have an adequate amount of plant-based foods, especially leafy greens and cruciferous vegetables like cauliflower and broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cabbage. They're all inexpensive and underrated, and so are kale and spinach and lettuces. You really want to make sure that there's a lot of green on your plate. And then fruit is getting a really bad rap. But I think we should really pay attention to the fact that antioxidants in fruit are very important for health. And then if you don't want to eat grains, that's up to you. But at least veggies and fruit should be a very important part of everybody's diet. Number 3, meditation for sleep and stress. We need to realize that lack of sleep and too much stress are also really bad for your hormonal production when it comes to menopause and the symptoms of menopause. There's one study in particular that I like to talk about that looked at thousands of people starting in midlife and beyond, and they show the chronically high cortisol or stress levels are linked to memory changes. Memory declines already in midlife for both men and women, but brain shrinkage only affects women. So this is something that was really eye-opening for me, and I think that there's something to be said about stress reduction techniques. They should be part of everybody's medical workup because we know that exercise really helps fight stress and support mood, which is very important. Meditation has been quite underrated in medicine for a long time, but there's increasing evidence that it really has a positive effect on the brain. Anyone who meditates will tell you it actually makes a difference. There are some meditation techniques that are intimidating because they're complicated. You need training and you have to go somewhere. You need the guide. But there are shorter meditations that anyone can do. There's one that I personally practice called Kirtan Kriya. That's K-I-R-T-A-N, then a second word, K-R-I-Y-A. It comes from Kundalini Yoga, from that tradition, and it takes 12 minutes. You are chanting, but you don't have to, and you repeat the word Satanama for 12 minutes while doing finger tapping, and you can find it on Spotify. You can find it on YouTube. It takes really 12 minutes. But if you do it consistently for a few months at a time, it's been shown to improve blood flow to the brain, reduce cortisol levels, and support overall mood and stress levels in women in clinical trials. Anyone can do it, and it seems to really be helpful. Still in wellness, this next article is My Vitiligo Diagnosis Gave Me a Crash Course in Self-Acceptance. In honor of Vitiligo Awareness Month, a recently diagnosed woman bears all. A few weeks before the first COVID lockdown began, I noticed a few small white spots on my forearms. As a SoCal beach girl who grew up in the sunscreen-free 80s, I figured it was sun damage. So did my dermatologist. Then the tiny sprinkles turned into paint splotches. I started treatment for tinea versicolor, a common skin fungal infection, but that was fruitless, and before long, huge swaths of my arms were milky white, which, as an already pale white girl, is saying a lot. That's when I was handed a surprising diagnosis, vitiligo. I've never even been able to commit to a tattoo, so the idea that my new piebald appearance was most likely permanent was a lot to process, especially in these early panicked days of the pandemic, when grocery shopping with a visible skin condition made me feel even more self-conscious and ostracized. The autoimmune disease affects 1 in 100 people in the U.S., yet vitiligo is shrouded in a lack of understanding, stigma, and underrepresentation. In honor of Vitiligo Awareness Month, I asked Nada Elbuluk, that's E-L-B-U-L-U-K, M.D., Clinical Associate Professor of Dermatology at USC Keck School of Medicine and founder and director of the USC Skin of Color Center and Pigmentary Disorders Program, to shed some light on the condition. What is vitiligo? Vitiligo, in a nutshell, is an autoimmune condition where people's antibodies are attacking a skin cell called a melanocyte, says Elbuluk. Melanocytes produce and contain melanin, or pigment. So wherever they get destroyed is what people develop these white patches that we call vitiligo. How do you get it? First things first, it's not contagious. And it's an equal opportunity condition. There are no demographic differences that we're aware of, either with gender or racial ethnic groups, Elbuluk says. People who develop vitiligo are genetically predisposed to it. But when and how the condition presents is a bit more mysterious, nebulously influenced by environmental factors, personal health, and even someone's mental state. At some point, that predisposition is going to combine with some other trigger in your life for the vitiligo to come out, Elbuluk says. Oftentimes, the trigger is some sort of injury. That can be something as simple as I skinned my knee and then I saw vitiligo there, Elbuluk says. Or I got a really bad sunburn when I was in my 20s and then I got vitiligo. Another common trigger, stress. Like, say, the anxiety-inducing cocktail of parenting and working during a global shutdown from a rampant, unknown virus. John Hamm, another famous vitiligen, yes, I just invented that word, has said his depigmentation started shortly after he was cast as Don Draper in Mad Men. No pressure. But for many, it's hard to pinpoint a trigger. Can it be treated? There is no cure, but there are treatments aimed at slowing or stopping vitiligo spread, which can range from a localized area to all over the body, and restoring skin color in depigmented areas. Topical creams are the most common. Oral medicines can be prescribed for really active, widespread cases, though the side effects can be more physically detrimental than vitiligo. And certain minerals and supplements seem to help. Last year, the first ever FDA-approved topical treatment, what's known as a JAK inhibitor, was released, meaning that the condition is finally getting some more attention in the medical field. And one of the most long-standing treatments is light therapy. What's more successful is a combination approach, says Elbluk. Is it harmful? Vitiligo is a medical condition, but it won't kill you. It doesn't hurt. And though its spread is completely unpredictable, its effects are mainly aesthetic. It is, however, associated with other autoimmune diseases. Up to 20 to 30% of people can also have thyroid disease, Elbuluk says. So far, vitiligo is my only condition, but I make sure my health practitioner regularly screens for anything else that may pop up. The real toll of vitiligo is on mental health. It can have really profound psychological and emotional effects on people, their self-esteem, their self-confidence. I have found this to be true across skin colors, Elbluk says. A lot of people don't feel comfortable with their vitiligo being visible or known to the world. That's how I was feeling when I decided to try to regain some pigmentation. It hadn't been a priority when I'd been holed up at home, but once the world opened up again, easing back into socializing with totally different skin, fielding side-eyed from strangers and lots of questions from kids, my preference, was an emotional struggle. By this time, I had vitiligo on every part of my body. Splotches on my face, neck, and chest, random spots on my back and belly, confetti sprinkles on my thighs, and tie-dye-like patterns on my lower legs. My derm started me on a topical cream for my face and arms, a supplement regimen, vitamins D, C, and E, plus alpha-lipoic acid, an antioxidant, and light therapy 2 times a week, which had me driving to a treatment center in downtown L.A. and standing naked in what looks like an old-school tanning booth to get zapped with a particular UV light known to stimulate pigmentation. Within a few months, I started getting freckles on my arms, and those freckles slowly expanded until most of the white patches on my arms and hands had filled in. And then I stopped light therapy. Just wasn't worth it. I've gotten used to my splotchy skin and people's reactions to it. Plus, getting to appointments was a royal pain in the behind, and the copy mates were adding up, and the co-payments were adding up. I decided to put that energy into enjoying my body, no matter what it looked like. What about the mental impact? Elbaluk often recommends speaking with a psychologist for support, or a psychiatrist, especially for patients with depression or anxiety. Local groups can be really powerful for people with vitiligo and for families, especially parents of children with vitiligo, she says. She's a board member of the Global Vitiligo Foundation, an organization for medical practitioners and those living with vitiligo alike. They host an annual symposium, offer an online community, and have a searchable database of local support groups. For me, the body positivity movement helped shift my attitude toward acceptance. They don't have vitiligo, but size and disability activists like Virgie Tovar and Ruella Maria Mattson remind me how good inclusivity feels, and to give myself that grace as well. Plus, as a near lifelong feminist, I've had a lot of practice in reclaiming my body and unsubscribing from the impossible beauty standards of a patriarchal society. I still take vitamins, which are good for my health in general. I also manage my stress the best I can. But there's always a new white spot to contend with. Turns out, celebrating them feels way better than constantly trying to overcome them. Representation helps more than anything. Seeing Winnie Harlow on the runway or the cover of a magazine makes my heart sing. In 2020, Mattel released a Barbie with vitiligo, and every time I spy a skin-dappled model in an ad or fashion spread or in the photos of an online shop I love, I relish the normalization. The Instagram account at vitiligo.beauty is also a salve when self-consciousness creeps in. These days, thankfully, that's a rare occurrence. It took a few years, but I've managed to go from just living with vitiligo to actually loving it, because these spots have only strengthened my steadfast sense of self. Okay, we've moved on to books. This one is Read Obama's Powerful Open Letter to Librarians Amid Book Bans. For weeks, many of us have been obsessively refreshing former President Barack Obama's social media pages in frenzied anticipation of his annual summer reading list drop. But yesterday, he took to Twitter for a different literary mission, to take a stand against book bans. In an open letter addressed to the dedicated and hardworking librarians of America, Obama describes how books have shaped his personal identity as well as the identity of the nation. In America, the First Amendment of our Constitution states that freedom begins with our capacity to share and access ideas, even, and maybe especially, the ones we disagree with, the letter reads. More often than not, someone decides to write those ideas down in a book. Today, the letter continues, some of the books that shape my life and the lives of so many others are being challenged by people who disagree with certain ideas or perspectives. Librarians, Obama contends, are on the front lines of the battle over literary censorship. The American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom documented some 1,269 calls to censor library books and resources in 2022, the highest number the organization has ever reported over its more than 20 years of data collection and nearly twice as many attempted bans as the year before. As Obama notes in his letter, these censorship attempts target books that are often written by or feature people of color, indigenous people, and members of the LGBTQ+ community. Indeed, for 2 years running, Gender Queer, a graphic memoir by Maya Kobab that chronicles the author's own adolescent exploration of gender and sexuality, has been the most banned book in the United States. The spelling of that name is M-A-I-A, second name K-O-B-A-B-E. According to PEN America, 40% of banned titles from July 2021 to June 2022 had protagonists or prominent secondary characters of color, and 21% of banned titles directly related to issues of race and racism. But Obama is careful to note that this issue can affect people across the world and political spectrum. There have also been unfortunate instances in which books by conservative authors or books containing triggering words or scenes have been targets for removal. He points out an American censorship risks setting off a global domino effect. If this nation, built on freedom of expression, silenced certain voices, why should other countries go out of their way to protect them? Obama ends the letter by thanking librarians for the vital and uniquely American role they play in the life of our nation, and by urging every citizen reading this to remind anyone who will listen, and even some people you think might not, of the importance of free and open dialogue to American democracy. Obama also made cameos in promotional TikTok videos posted by the Harris County Library in Texas and the Kankakee Public Library in Illinois, and the latter of which included the hashtags #freedomtoread and #letfreedomread in its caption. You can read the full letter in the tweet below and join Obama in the Unite Against Book Bans campaign led by the American Library Association at http://uniteagainstbookbans.org. And here is the full letter that Barack Obama wrote, July 17, 2023, to the dedicated and hardworking librarians of America. In any democracy, the free exchange of ideas is an important part of making sure that citizens are informed, engaged, and feel like their perspectives matter. It's so important, in fact, that here in America, the First Amendment of our Constitution states that freedom begins with our capacity to share and access ideas, even and maybe especially the ones we disagree with. More often than not, someone decides to write those ideas down in a book. Books have always shaped how I experience the world. Writers like Mark Twain and Toni Morrison, Walt Whitman, and James Baldwin taught me something essential about our country's character. Reading about people whose lives were very different from mine showed me how to step into someone else's shoes, and the simple act of writing helped me develop my own identity, all of which would prove vital as a citizen, as a community organizer, and as president. Today, some of the books that shape my life and the lives of so many others are being challenged by people who disagree with certain ideas or perspectives. It's no coincidence that these banned books are often written by or feature people of color, indigenous people, and members of the LGBTQ+ community. Though there have always been unfortunate instances in which books by conservative authors or books containing triggering words or scenes have been targets for removal. Either way, the impulse seems to be to silence rather than engage, rebuke, learn from, or seek to understand views that don't fit our own. I believe such an approach is profoundly misguided and contrary to what has made this country great. As I've said before, not only is it important for young people from all walks of life to see themselves represented in the pages of books, but it's also important for all of us to engage with different ideas and points of view. It's also important to understand that the world is watching. If America, a nation built on freedom of expression, allows certain voices and ideas to be silenced, why should other countries go out of their way to protect them? Ironically, it is Christian and other religious texts, the sacred texts that some calling for book bannings in this country claim to want to defend, that have often been the first target of censorship and book banning efforts in authoritarian countries. Nobody understands that more than you, our nation's librarians. In a very real sense, you're on the front lines, fighting every day to make the widest possible range of viewpoints, opinions, and ideas available to everyone. Your dedication and professional expertise allow us to freely read and consider information and ideas and decide for ourselves which ones we agree with. That's why I want to take a moment to thank all of you for the work you do every day, work that is helping us understand each other and embrace our shared humanity. And it's not just about books. You also provide spaces where people can come together, share ideas, participate in community programs, and access essential civic and educational resources. Together, you help people become informed and active citizens, capable of making this country what they want it to be. And you do it all in a harsh political climate, where all too often you're attacked by people who either cannot or will not understand the vital and uniquely American role you play in the life of our nation. So whether you just started working at a school or public library, or you've been there your entire career, Michelle and I want to thank you for your unwavering commitment to the freedom to read. All of us owe you a debt of gratitude for making sure readers across the country have access to a wide range of books and all the ideas they contain. Finally, to every citizen reading this, I hope you'll join me in reminding anyone who will listen, and even some people you think might not, that the free, robust exchange of ideas has always been at the heart of American democracy. Together, we can make that true for generations to come. With gratitude, Barack Obama. Over in culture and news. Today, fans aren't holding back after Al Roker's passionate reaction to intense on-air debate. Al wasn't prepared at all for this segment on the NBC show. Al Roker is no stranger when it comes to hearing some interesting conversations on the Today show. But one segment left him completely in shock, and his reaction had fans in stitches over it. During a July 18th segment on the morning news show, Al sat with Dylan Dreyer and Chenille Jones as they were quizzed on how many times dermatologists recommended a person to shower per week. While Dylan and Chenille guessed 5 times and every day, respectively, Al had a visceral opinion when contributing guest Adriana Brock asked him his thoughts on hygiene. "I don't care what they say, I'm going to say A," he said, referencing his thoughts that folks should shower every day. What's more, when he discovered that dermatologists in fact recommend someone shower 2 to 3 times a week, Al was flabbergasted by the statistic. As Adriana explained that the number had to do with a person's lifestyle preferences, Al couldn't hold back his feelings on the subject as a whole. "Lifestyle?" he exclaimed on the air. "Not if you come in contact with other people." This prompted Dylan to ask Al how many times he bathes on a typical week, and he surprised her with an even more staggering confession. "I shower 2 times a day, he told her while still in disbelief. When Today's show fans saw Al's uproar over the surprise data about washing habits, they couldn't help but laugh at this over-the-top reaction online. "I am on Team Al," one person wrote on TikTok. "Team Al 2 times daily, always," another agreed. "Every day, Al is correct. My natural microbiome always agrees," someone else added. As viewers may know, this isn't the first time a topic has elicited a strong response from the NBC co-host. Back in February, he had to take off his glasses while processing a conversation about pajamas with Dylan, Chenille, and Craig Melvin. Then later in April, Al appeared astounded upon hearing Savannah Guthrie, Jenna Bush Hager, and Hoda Kotb's organization techniques, causing him to put his hands over his face. Well, folks can always count on Al to keep things real. And also in culture and news, Jamie Foxx just broke his silence about his recovery from illness. The actor says he went to hell and back in his first public statement since being hospitalized earlier this year. Jamie Foxx has just spoken publicly for the first time since a health scare led to him being hospitalized in April this year. While the media have reported on updates from Foxx's daughter, friends, and colleagues, Foxx himself has remained elusive, bar a couple of vague social media posts. However, the actor just shared a lot more detail about his condition and his recovery in a new Instagram reel. Foxx began by thanking everybody who has been praying for him and explained why he has stayed out of the public eye for so long. "I know a lot of people were waiting or wanting to hear updates, but to be honest with you, I just didn't want to see me like that. I didn't want you to see me like that man," he said. "I want you to see me laughing, having a good time, partying, cracking a joke, doing a movie, television show. I didn't want you to see me with tubes running out of me and trying to figure out if I was going to make it through. I cannot tell you how great it feels to have your family kick in such a way. And y'all know that kept it airtight. They didn't let nothing out. They protected me, and that's what I hope that everyone could have in moments like these," he continued. Foxx went on to dispel the rumors that have been circulating, shutting down speculation that his illness has left him blind and paralyzed. "I went to hell and back," he said, "and my road to recovery has some potholes as well. I just want to say that I love everybody, and I love all of the love that I got," he added. "It was tough, man. I was sick, but now I've got my legs under me, so you're going to see me out. I am on my way back." Next in culture and news, Lindsay Lohan welcomes her first child, a baby boy. His name is so adorable. Lindsay Lohan is a mom. The Mean Girls alum has given birth to her first child with husband Bader Shammas, the actor's rep confirmed to Pop Sugar today. The pair welcomed a beautiful, healthy son named Luai, L-U-A-I, the rep said. The family is over the moon. The news comes just a few days after the actor shared photos on Instagram of her picture-perfect baby nursery, which is decorated in soothing white and blue tones. She designed the space with the help of Nestig Baby. In the first photo, Lohan is standing inside the baby's charming room, looking fabulous in a white knit sleeveless dress. She cradles her baby bump as she smiles at the camera. "So excited to show you my nursery and the collection I designed with Nestig Baby. Everything is inspired by the beach and is so peaceful and playful," Lohan wrote in the post caption. "I loved working with at Nestig Baby to create my dream nursery. Everything is handmade and perfect for any little one in your life. You can shop my full collection at the link in bio, hashtag Nestig Partner." Lohan announced the happy news of her pregnancy in a sweet Instagram post back in March. "We are blessed and excited," she captioned a photo of a white baby onesie that read "Coming Soon" laid out on a bed. Since announcing her pregnancy, Lohan has shared updates via photos on Instagram. In May, she posted snaps of herself lounging in a one-piece swimsuit while showing off her growing baby bump. And in June, she shared a mirror selfie in which she glowed in a breezy white sundress. In culture and news, this article is Reese Witherspoon says divorce from Jim Toth is a vulnerable time for her. Reese Witherspoon has opened up about her divorce from Jim Toth for the first time since releasing a joint statement announcing the split in March. Speaking to Harper's Bazaar, Witherspoon said, "It's interesting what happened to me. When I was divorced before, the tabloid media got to tell people how I was feeling or how I was processing, and it felt very out of control. To be able to talk to people directly about what's going on in my life and just share it in a way that I share great professional experiences or personal experiences, it feels much more authentic to be able to say things in my own voice and not let somebody else control what's happening. Then, of course, there's speculation, but I can't control that. All I can do is be my most honest, forthright self and be vulnerable. It's a vulnerable time for me." She added that things have slowed down just a little bit, but that her brain has been going nonstop and just life changes and running a company. "But that's okay. I really believe creativity is infinite, and you're just looking for that next bit of inspiration. So if you go through a little slow period, that's okay. Witherspoon added that, "I think about how many other people are going through this experience. I don't feel isolated at all. I feel very connected." Witherspoon and Toth's original statement on their split, which has since been deleted from Instagram, reads, "We have some personal news to share. It is with a great deal of care and consideration that we have made the difficult decision to divorce. We have enjoyed so many wonderful years together and are moving forward with deep love, kindness, and mutual respect for everything we have created together." In Wellness, we have the article, "What is Performance Anxiety?" That heart-racing, shaky hands, sweaty palms feeling you experience before a big event? It's totally normal, according to psychologists. Here's how to deal. At the risk of sounding wacky, it was Eminem who put it best when he rapped, "Palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy." And if you've ever experienced that same physical, an emotional roller coaster right before a big event, even if you didn't end up with mom's spaghetti on your sweater, you're likely all too familiar with performance anxiety. Maybe you go into panic mode right before an important meeting at work, or your body feels all kinds of symptoms before you have to speak publicly, even if you're normally a social butterfly. So what's the deal with performance anxiety anyway? Why does it happen, and is that heart-racing, sweaty-palmed, full-body-buzzing feeling actually curable? What even is performance anxiety? You might be surprised to learn that performance anxiety is a type of social anxiety. As Terry Bacow, Ph.D., a cognitive behavioral psychologist and author of Goodbye Anxiety, explains, it stems from a fear of negative evaluation from others, which is a core feature of social anxiety disorder or social phobia. Though anyone can experience performance anxiety, even if they don't typically deal with other types of anxiety or social phobias. You might hear it referred to as stage fright, says Fanny Tristan, a New York City-based therapist, though you don't have to be acting, singing, or dancing on stage to feel those uncomfortable jitters and negative thought patterns. It is not uncommon for people to have very specific social or performance concerns, Bacow says. For example, you have no problem making conversations with strangers, but you're terrified of public speaking. People who struggle with performance anxiety are very concerned about messing up in a performance situation, whether it's acting, playing a sport, performing live, or giving a speech. They overestimate the likelihood that they will screw up and that others will notice and judge them. The stakes feel very high. She notes that it's characterized by a heightened sense of self-consciousness, increased self-monitoring, hypervigilance, and a belief that everyone is looking at you and scrutinizing your performance. Many people with performance anxiety engage in negative self-talk. If this doesn't go perfectly, it will be terrible, and worry they aren't good enough. What are the telltale signs and symptoms? Not sure if what you're working with is performance anxiety? Internally, you may feel psychological symptoms of anxiety, racing heart, muscle tension, stomach butterflies, sweatiness. And when you think about performing, or about to perform, or during the performance, says Bacow, you also might also experience trouble breathing, notes Tristan. Who suffers from it? Like any other kind of anxiety, performance anxiety tends to stem from a combination of genes and environmental influences. Anxiety runs in families and is highly genetic, says Bacow. Performance anxiety in particular may be more likely to manifest if a person grows up in a high-pressure environment, where perhaps their parents communicated high standards or expectations of excellence or achievement, or were critical when they did not overachieve or perform well in school or extracurricular activities. Many people across all demographics struggle with performance anxiety, adds Tristan. It makes sense when you live in a world where there might be so much expected from you or others around you. You can also experience performance anxiety in many different settings, from a performance on stage or a presentation at work, or even ordering food in a crowded deli. Both pro notes that it's incredibly common, even if you don't normally struggle with anxiety in social settings or otherwise. Bacow says that the feeling can come and go, which means you might be able to give a wedding toast with ease, but struggle with a work presentation. Is it serious? On its own, performance anxiety is natural. But if it's something that impairs your ability to function on a regular basis, Tristan recommends working with a mental health professional. If you're placing your job in jeopardy, isolating from others for extended periods of time, or feel like your anxiety symptoms are chronic, they can assess your symptoms further and create a personalized plan with you to feel and function better. The good thing is that it's temporary, even when it doesn't feel that way, says Tristan. Sometimes performance anxiety is so overwhelming that it warps the way you see what's in front of you. You start to believe the task in front of you is more of a threat than a temporary, uncomfortable experience. What does anxiety treatment look like? So how can you cope? A therapist trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, will help you see that nobody really cares about your performance, even when it feels super high stakes, says Bacow. You learn not to fear failure so much as to have more moderate standards for yourself. This type of therapy provides great tools that focus on the relationship between your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, says Tristan. Tristan says to use affirmations and challenging your thoughts as tools to help ground you back to reality. For example, remind yourself of the temporary nature of what you're about to do, or playing out the realistic consequences of not doing things perfectly can help lower the stakes you might be feeling about the task itself. No matter how uncomfortable you're feeling, know you're not alone and you can get through it. And when everything seems overwhelming, a trusted therapist can help you navigate your feelings and feel better over time. This article is over in Lifestyle. Meet the woman who wants to create a kinder world for animals. Lori Dover, president and founder of St. Huckleberry Animal Fund, has been hard at work on her mission for the past few years. You could say that for Lori Dover, ensuring that animals receive quality care is more than her passion, it's her purpose. In fact, she has dedicated her life to putting all animals first. In 2021, Dover founded St. Huckleberry Animal Fund, an organization that prioritizes animal well-being through advocacy, fundraising, and more, in her hometown of Lake Charles, Louisiana, after a few devastating instances of animal mistreatment. Dover's kitten, Huckleberry, was the target of a hate crime in 2018. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic and four natural disasters were creating an animal welfare crisis in the southwest part of the state. Hurricanes Laura and Delta hit in 2020, plus an ice and snowstorm and fatal flash flood in 2021, during which Dover rescued a beloved kitten named Lord Sugarplum Puddington, who has since become part of her world. People had been dumping their pet cats in the gully of the Walmart neighborhood market on Ryan Street, so for over 2 years I fed, rescued, provided veterinary care, and transported these abandoned pets to my network of friends and partnerships outside the city. Dover tells Oprah Daily. She says that a greater number of extreme weather events are predicted to occur because of climate change, so she promotes the preparedness of both animals and humans. Can you tell us about your background? My roots are Southern, and the greatest influence in my life was my mother, also a true blue animal lover. She believed that the grand essentials of happiness in life are something to do, someone to love, and something to look forward to. I would like to amend that to include courage. My career background in product innovation is in the pet sector. I debuted an illuminated LED technology, fiber optic dog safety leash on QVC in February 2019. I will expand and scale up to launch an e-commerce online pet company, Pets R, then that's the letter R, family that will supply quality products, value, and care for animals and their pet parents. What inspired you to start St. Huckleberry Animal Fund? The inspiration behind St. Huckleberry Animal Fund was born out of loss and heartbreak, but unfortunately not uncommon heartbreak to pet parents. My beloved kitten, Huckleberry, was the victim of a hate crime. It fueled me to become more politically engaged and advocate for stronger animal cruelty laws, like a bipartisan piece of legislation. The ACE, Animal Cruelty Enforcement Act, co-sponsored my four bipartisan U.S. senators. One cannot legislate love, kindness, and respect for animals, but there should be codified laws in place that are enforced, and in the ACE Act, the DOJ will do just that. What did the organization focus on initially? The animal welfare crisis unfolding in southwest Louisiana, resulting from the global pandemic and the four historic disasters that shredded the city, these went without national coverage and a federal aid package for 18 months, until a Wall Street Journal story I pitched went live on February 20, 2022. I reached out to policymakers and civic and industry leadership and formed partnerships with Weruva, W-E-R-U-V-A, Wellness Pet Company, Newman's Own, and Dr. Elsie's, which all generously donated pet food and supplies to my St. Huckleberry Animal Fund welfare mission. What initiatives or projects are you now focusing on at the fund now? I am laser-focused on launching affordable St. Huckleberry Animal Fund hospitals in cities, towns, and rural communities across North America. They will provide quality, affordable veterinary care and MASH, Mobile Animal Sterilization Hospital, clinics to remedy the animal overpopulation crisis, and will accept pet insurance as pet parents now pay their vets more than their primary care physicians. The St. Huckleberry Animal Fund hospital model will potentially revolutionize the well-being of animals nationally. What accomplishments are you most proud of? By creating a network of hope and esprit de corps for these abandoned animals, I am proud and grateful to connect with like-minded professionals in a multitude of sectors who also believe that one person can make a positive difference and know that together we can move mountains and transform, improve, and save lives, both animal and human. My St. Huckleberry Animal Fund mission is to make the world a safer, kinder, and better place for all animals through policy change and advanced technological innovation, and to provide and promote the humane treatment of all animals by building a global movement to end animal cruelty. In lifestyle, we have rage gardening. It's a thing. How escaping into her yard helped a mentally exhausted woman rebound. On my 18th wedding anniversary this past May, my husband gave me beautiful potted red Gerbera daisies. It was a lovely gesture, but as I read the attached care card, a wave of exhaustion washed over me. Sun to part shade, prefers a cool, well-drained environment, fertilize often. I smiled, genuinely touched by the thought of his present, but also feeling like I could not take care of one more thing, not even a plant. If you are a primary caregiver or a woman with a lot on her plate, you can probably relate to this type of fatigue. By the time I'm done setting up doctor visits and teaching conferences, finding repairmen, getting the dog a leptospirosis vaccine, whatever that is, and reminding my family of their responsibilities, which they perceive as nagging, all while focusing on my own career as a journalist, I am so overwhelmed I feel like I might explode. Then I become obsessed with shame and guilt for having these feelings. With my high schooler living 3,500 miles away while he plays soccer abroad, navigating day-to-day life mostly on his own, I've tried to strike an elusive balance of being as supportive as possible while providing space for him to learn and grow. There are days I'm left wondering if I've done more harm than good. The often unrecognized, invisible work of suppressing or downplaying our emotions to benefit others is known as emotional labor. This burden can overlap with unpaid physical and mental labor, such as household chores, scheduling appointments, planning family activities, and remembering and delegating tasks. And no surprise, the majority of it falls on women. Studies show that women do about 5 hours of unpaid work per day compared to men's 3. One evening, as I sat on my friend's porch sipping tea, I confessed to her that all this emotional and mental labor was making me start to feel ragey. "Have you tried gardening?" she suggested as she refilled my cup. I laughed. "Who has time for gardening?" "There's nothing more satisfying than ripping out a stubborn root and hacking it to pieces," said my usually demure friend. "So like rage gardening?"
"Exactly."
"I've read that being in nature and digging in the soil are great for stress reduction, decreased depression, and enhanced memory retention, but it sounded almost too good to be true. So I reached out to clinical psychologist Joanne Finkelstein, PhD author of a yet-to-be-titled forthcoming book about raising emotional healthy girls in a sexist world, to learn more. "Gardening is a physical, sensual, mental experience," she explained. "The physicality and limitless potential for creativity engage our muscles, fine motor skills, vision, and imagination. It takes us out of our heads and into our bodies, which can be healing. There's science backing all of this. Microbes in soil have been shown to help regulate our emotions and our immune response, and fresh air and sunlight increase mood-boosting serotonin, a hormone that helps us feel calm and focus, acting as a natural antidepressant. If gardening could help soothe my rage and leave my feeling centered, I'd be willing to slather those microbes all over me." Suddenly, making time to garden didn't sound like such a bad idea. A few days after my tea time confession, my head pounding from stress as I did mental gymnastics to get through my to-do list, I looked over at the now drooping daisies on my counter. The sun was shining and the lilacs were in full bloom, but I was tired and irritable. Emotional labor is exhausting because with so much to do and so little time to replenish yourself, the constancy and monotony takes its toll. It feels like your brain actually hurts, Finkelstein had told me. I grabbed the plant and walked outside. As I searched for the heavy steel shovel in the garage, I wondered if I had the energy for this new project. I wiped the spider webs off the shovel, looked for space in my neglected garden, which I'd started earlier in the pandemic, and began digging. The ground was hard, and I had to pound the shovel with my foot to break through the clay soil. I kneeled and finished scooping dirt with my hands. When I was done, I looked around and saw the weeds growing around me. I couldn't help but appreciate the irony. I was literally in the weeds of marriage and motherhood. This article was edited due to time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.